Today on Point of the Spear.
People get it mixed up with Operation Fortitude and the D-Day deception, but it's really completely different. It starts after D-Day. It's an American unit of 1,100 guys, and they are basically doing impersonation, Rob. They're trying to pretend that they're other much larger units, and to do that, they're using inflatable tanks and sound effects and illusion of various types, radio trickery, fake headquarters, phony generals. Amazing story.
Author and filmmaker Rick Byers here to talk about the Ghost Army, and we'll hear from him right after this break. I'm Robert Child, and this is Point of the Spear. Welcome back. Today's guest is a New York Times best-selling author and documentary filmmaker, and has produced films for the History Channel, A&E, the Smithsonian, PBS, and more. He's been on a mission to secure a coveted gold medal for a little-known American World War II unit, and the effort is called the Ghost Army Legacy Project. And author and filmmaker Rick Byers joins us now. Rick, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here, Rob. Thank you very much.
And for our listeners, Rick and I have known each other for years because we've come from the trenches, the same trenches, the documentary film.
The parallel tracks of World War II documentaries about little-known units, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And for folks who don't know about the Ghost Project, the Ghost Army, this began as a documentary that released on PBS in 2013 and then became a New York Times best-selling book. Tell folks a little bit about the Ghost Army.
Sure. So the unit at the heart of this that I call the Ghost Army, that others call the Ghost Army, was officially called the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops. There's a boring mouthful of a name for you. But it was an amazing unit in World War II involved in deception, in battlefield deception, in trying to fool the Germans on the battlefields of Europe. People get it mixed up with Operation Fortitude and the D-Day deception, but it's really completely different. It starts after D-Day. It's an American unit of 1,100 guys, and they are basically doing impersonation, Rob. They're trying to pretend that they're other much larger units, and to do that, they're using inflatable tanks and sound effects and illusion of various types, radio trickery, fake headquarters, phony generals, amazing story. And they don't do it once or twice. They do it 21, 22 different times, starting about a week after D-Day and going until the end of the war. So that's the basic story of the unit that is the Ghost Army.
The veterans from the Ghost Army, I was watching an interview earlier this morning with one of your veterans, and he mentioned that they had to keep it secret. It couldn't be revealed for years until after the war, until I think you said 1996. Is that true?
Yeah, so the unit was classified, of course. You know, you've got a secret unit. You don't want people to know about it. And they kept it classified. They kept all the documents classified. Many of the soldiers were told not to talk about it for about 50 years after the war, until it was declassified finally in 1996. And interestingly, Rob, there was some leakage on that. It wasn't a perfect secrecy bubble. This little newspaper called the New York Times has an article, for example, about the Ghost Army in November 1945. There are a few others, but they then kind of shut it down. And in fact, it was very interesting because one of the guys in the unit who later worked in the Eisenhower White House, Fred Fox, he tried to get it declassified. Let's declassify the official history so I can write a book about this. And the Pentagon said, no way. They didn't want to declassify it because basically they didn't mind a little leak here or there about, oh, inflatable tanks, whatever. But they didn't want the details of how they carried out this deception against the Germans to fall into the hands of the Russians. They wanted to preserve that capability, you know, in the possibility of the Cold War.
I see. You've been with this project, obviously, since before 2013.
Dinosaurs. Before dinosaurs were roaming the Earth, yes. 2005 is when I started on this project.
Yeah, that's similar to me with the Wareth 11 project.
Sure.
I started in 2009. But you've taken it from the film and the book, and it's grown into the Legacy Project. Tell us a little bit about that and what was the catalyst to create that.
Sure, right. So I made this documentary, which took 8 years to make the documentary, another couple of years to write the book that followed up after that. And, at that point, I guess I could have said I was done, but I felt like the job wasn't finished. I mean, I just had this nagging feeling that there was more to do. There was all this material out there, letters and documents and stuff that wasn't gathered in any one place. There weren't any markers on the battlefields in Europe where they carried out their deceptions. I really still felt like the unit had been under-recognized. And so, with some like-minded folks, we started the Ghost Army Legacy Project as a nonprofit about 5 years ago. And I was just looking back before our interview at the goals of that when we set out to do it. And we've accomplished a bunch of them because we talked about trying to get the Congressional Gold Medal, and we're very close to that. We can talk more about that. We have put up two historical markers in Europe, and we're trying to get a third one underway. And there's actually been several museum exhibits that we have been involved with, and we've built a pretty substantial Ghost Army archive that we then donated to the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. So those are the kinds of things that I felt like needed to be done, and we've gotten a lot of them done. The name of the organization is Ghost Army Legacy Project, so it's about legacy, it's about remembering, and it also has the word project in it because we didn't perceive this, and I still don't perceive this as like a organization that's going to be around forever, but it was trying to accomplish these goals to remember the unit and kind of set it a little bit more firmly in U.S. historical memory so that that it would be there for people in the future to kind of discover and be amazed by.
I see. You mentioned the National World War II Museum, and you have a traveling exhibit with them coming up. Is it next year? When does that launch?
Well, so the World War II Museum exhibit actually already played out as a temporary exhibit at the World War II Museum. That was last year, but it's on the move, as you mentioned, and it's coming to Chicago in June, to the Illinois Holocaust Museum. And then I think in March of next year, it goes to the Nevada Art Museum, in Reno, Nevada. Now, Rob, you may say, wait a minute. Okay, Rick, what kind of exhibit can go be at a World War II museum and a Holocaust museum and an art museum? And that would be the Ghost Army, Rob, because one of the aspects of the story that if you've watched the film or if you read the book or frankly, if you look at our website, comes up pretty quickly, is a bunch of guys in this unit were artists, and they painted and sketched their way through the battlefields of Europe, and some of them went on to become famous, like Ellsworth Kelly, famous minimalist artist, or Bill Blass, not so famous now as he used to be, but really famous in the 80s as a fashion designer. And so that's probably why the Nevada Museum of Art is interested in it. But it's going to those two museums. And then we're not sure after that where it's headed. It's up there on the World War II Museum website with all the rental information and everything. So if you're a museum curator listening in, yeah, go get the Ghost Army Museum exhibit for 20 sometime in 2022, 2023.
Well, that could be a potential tie-in to a potential movie. I know a couple years ago the book was optioned, and Hollywood is very fickle, and I understand that a very prominent director is involved. Tell us about where it stands, the Hollywood version of the story.
Oh, it's a sad tale, Rob. Yeah, it was optioned about 5 years ago. Really, it was right around the time the book came out. So I guess that's, yeah, 5, 6 years ago. And great progress was made. We were very excited. Screenplay was written. Then somebody else wrote, a different screenwriter wrote a second screenplay for the studio. Universal Studios was involved. Andrew Lazar, the producer of American Sniper and a few other, small movies. And then they got Ben Affleck to agree to direct and star in it. And there was a point, I've lost track now, I would say 2 years ago or so, where I met with Ben Affleck. Ben Affleck was like gung ho on the project. I thought we were going to be going into production in a few weeks or months at that point. And then, in the mysterious way that Hollywood has, this project died. And honestly, dying is what most projects do, right? I mean, the in this case, I think there was some issues with maybe with money. Not really sure. I wasn't privy to that. When you're the creator of the underlying material, you're not privy to very much in that environment. And then suddenly the studio decided to let go of the option, and then suddenly COVID hit, but as I say often when I talk about this, if you're familiar with the movie The Princess Bride, we're mostly dead, right? We're not all dead, right? Because if you're all dead, as Billy Crystal said, all you can do is, go through the pockets and look for loose change. But when you're mostly dead, there's hope. And there's still hope on this. There's a lot of people. I still get inquiries from folks in Hollywood, and especially as we've gotten a lot of attention for our effort on the Congressional Gold Medal and other stuff. Gosh darn it, this is too good a story. Somebody will make a movie out of it eventually, or a series. I can't believe that it won't happen at some point. Whether you or I are still alive at that point is a whole different question. But it's a good story. It'll happen someday. And we're also looking at thinking about making a podcast out of just the Ghost Army story. So that's something else that's kind of been percolating, and we'll see how that goes.
I hope you're enjoying this episode. We've got some great guests coming up in December. The book is called Blood and Iron: The Rise and Fall of the German Empire, 1871 to 1918, and author Katja Heuer joins us now.
It's exactly 150 years ago this year, the creation of Germany in 1871, and so little debate was had about the fact that this made a huge impact on Europe and the world, obviously in lots of negative ways, but also lots of positive ways, and I think it deserves as many conversations as we can have about that.
His book is called Men Will Come, a history of the 314th Troop Carrier Group, 1942 to 1945, and retired Air Force colonel and author Mark Vlahos joins us now.
There's so much written about, the 8th Air Force and the bomber crews, but the troop carrier men, who wore this patch, right, the airborne troop carrier patch, and the glider pilots, who dropped the paramedics and flew aeromedically back in combat resupply missions. Most people don't, there's not much written about them, so I felt I needed to fill this void in history.
His book is called Island Infernos, the U.S. Army's Pacific War Odyssey, 1944. And author John McManus joins us now.
One of the things that had really occurred to me over the years is that one of the last kind of unexplored aspects of World War II from an American standpoint was the Army's experience in the Pacific. I noticed that there was this kind of mythology or sort of misconception, maybe is a better word, all these years later, that when it came to the ground fighting in the Pacific, that the Marines had really done the ground fighting, the Navy did everything else, and the Army focused on Europe, and that couldn't have been more untrue.
I hope you can join me for these guests and more every Wednesday morning. Point of the Spear. Well, I know there's a Band of Brothers podcast that was just
there's created. An everything is a podcast now.
Yes,
Rob. Everything is a podcast. But I mean, I do think that people are interested in narrative story podcasts, and so I think in addition to interview podcasts like this one, and so I think that's something that that I want to take a look at, and we'll see where the future goes on that.
Yeah, I do too. Just a quick follow-up to the potential movie. When you were involved with the creative discussions as a creator, how much input were you going to have on the script? Or was it something that you said, close your eyes and hope you do?
Think of England. If you had said control, I would say zero. Because, and people ask about that, well, how much control would you have over the movie? And I would say I would have zero control over a movie, because they don't, Hollywood studio in its right mind that it wants to spend, $40, $50, $60 million on a movie wants to give some documentary filmmaker in Chicago creative control of any part of that. Input, I had quite a bit of input. When the first screenwriter who wrote a screenplay, a wonderful person named Henry Gayden, and Henry also wrote not too similar, but he wrote the screenplay for Shazam and the new movie Shazam 2 that's coming out. Not exactly like the Ghost Army, but actually there are some similarities. The Ghost Army, they were superheroes too in their own way. And he and I spent many, many hours on the phone. You know, I mean, obviously I sent him, in addition to the book, I sent him all the original interviews that I'd done. I sent transcripts of the interviews. I sent letter collections. We chatted about different people. Most of it was one way in the sense that he didn't share with me. And frankly, I didn't really want to get a lot of information about the plot or what was being done. Because honestly, it's not, you know, I'm not a Hollywood filmmaker. I'm not a Hollywood screenwriter. And I don't fancy myself as a creator of fiction. So I wanted to help him as much as possible. And I felt really honored and respected in that process, which is, I think, may surprise some people in the sort of terms of Hollywood. Now, when that screenplay got as far as I guess people felt it was going to get, and a guy named Nick Pizzolatto, who's a very well-known screenwriter and director, wrote a second version of the screenplay. Yeah, I didn't have any input on that, you know, so I don't really know exactly what's in that. But I felt like, you know, I had a chance to make my point, and ultimately, Rob, I made my movie, right?
Right.
The documentary is my movie. And anything that any director does is going to fictionalize a bunch of things that are going to drive me and you and other history aficionados a little crazy. And that's just okay. I mean, that's the way it is. And my point of view would be, as long as they create something, you know, if you create something that gets the story out there, people can always use Google to go back and kind of check on what the real story is.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Now, you mentioned the Ghost Army Congressional Medal Act. Is that what
it's a lot of words in a row, isn't it? I've gotten it down over the past 5 years, the Congressional Gold Medal. Yes. The Ghost Army Congressional Gold Medal Act. Yes. Act.
Where does that stand?
That is in much better shape than the movie, Rob. Yeah. So, which honestly, 5 years ago, I would have thought that it would be reversed. But we are, in all seriousness, we have been working for quite some time to convince Congress to award the highest honor Congress can bestow, a Congressional Gold Medal, on this unit. And they've done this for other units like the Monuments Men or... the WAX, I think. I'm trying to come up with some of the other units. I'm not quite thinking of them, but they've used it in the past to honor sort of under-recognized World War II units. Where we stand right now is that the House has passed the legislation.
Oh, great.
And in the Senate, we need to get two-thirds of the Senate to co-sponsor the bill before it can actually be considered. And that's really unique to gold medal bills. And the idea is that you have to sort of show that it's universally, you know, desired. And we currently have 59 Senate co-sponsors. Actually, I think we have 61 now, 61 Senate co-sponsors, and we need six more. So six more senators. So we are on that and trying to get that to happen. Now, that doesn't...
Is there a deadline, though?
Well, the deadline, in essence, everything would reset at the end of the current session of Congress, which would be December of next year. But we don't need to... So we need to get to 67, and then some other things need to happen. I mean, it still would need to be voted on in the Senate, and then if there's any changes in the bill, it goes back to the House. So there's still a process after we get to 67. But our goal is to get to 67 this year and then try to make the bill happen early in the session next year. Knock on wood, I think we're in a good position. And, you know, we have lots of people working on this. I'm not alone. We've got family members. We've got people inspired by the unit. I've got teenage kids who've done National History Day projects on the Ghost Army who've become inspired by it. We have people in the House and Senate who are trying to bring on other people. So there's a pretty widespread effort. American Legion supports this, World War II Museum, National D-Day Memorial, American Veterans Center, other organizations. So it's a big push, and I think we're finally going to see it come to fruition. You know, I wouldn't bet the ranch on anything, but this is the one that I'm closest to being willing to do that on.
And it's in better shape than the movie.
It's in better shape than the movie. But you never know. Ben Affleck could call me. You know, I keep my ringer on. It could happen at any time. So.
Yeah, you could listen to this podcast.
Yeah, I imagine he will. So, I'm sure your reach is wide and far. But the gold medal's going real well, and I'm optimistic that will indeed happen. And nothing, there is no such thing as a sure thing or a gimme in this kind of area. And we have to keep putting the work in and avoid some sort of pitfall. I've learned a lot about lobbying and Congress and working with Congress in the last really 5 years. I've been trying to do this for 5 years, and so there's always the chance that something can go wrong, but it's in real great shape right now.
Good. The effort is called the Ghost Army Legacy Project. And Rick, thank you so much for being on the show. Where can people find out more about it?
Oh, I'm so happy to have the chance to talk about it, Rob. And people can find out more about our efforts and about this unit at ghostarmy.org. And dig in. There's lots of great stuff there. We've just touched on the tip of it today. Believe me, there's lots more to this story.
Great. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
That's it for this episode. Thanks again for joining me. Next time, my guest will be esteemed military historian and author John McManus.
One of the things that had really occurred to me over the years is that one of the last kind of unexplored aspects of World War II from an American standpoint was the Army's experience in the Pacific. I noticed that there was this kind of mythology or sort of misconception, maybe is a better word, all these years later, that when it came to the ground fighting in the Pacific, that the Marines had really done the ground fighting, the Navy did everything else, and the Army focused on Europe. And that couldn't have been more untrue.
That's next time. And if you like what you hear, leave a review or a rating or just click the follow button. You can find me on Twitter at Rob Child, where you can share your comments about the show. I'm Robert Child, and this has been Point of the Spear.
Music licensed from audioblocks.com. Point of the Spear is produced by RSC Media Group.